The Last Word with Matt Cooper.
Today FM.
It all happens here.
Today FM.
So, Saturday marks the 20th anniversary of possibly the landmark event of the 20th century, because so much, 21st century, because so much has flowed from it since. And that is the attacks on New York and Washington on 9/11. Marion McKeown, who you know well as our regular American contributor here on The Last Word in Today FM, now writing for the Business Post, was working with me in the Sunday Tribune back at the time. And Marion, I didn't realise until again, just remembered that we actually sent you down to the Twin Towers after the plane had struck the first tower, thinking it was an accident, effectively putting you into danger.
Well, you know, hello, Matt, and I didn't see it that way at all. It was, as you say, the first thing I remember was talking briefly to Martin Wall, who was the news editor then, and Martin and I chatted. It was just after about 10 to 9 in the morning, minutes after the first plane struck, and we both thought, and I was listening into NPR as well, that there had been an accident. Now, you'd see these helicopters circling around Manhattan with tourists in them, and you know, and little planes sometimes. And my instinct immediately was, oh my God, there's been an awful accident, and that was Martin's as well. And so I just said, look, I'm heading down now. Jumped in a taxi, and as you would, like any journalist in New York at that stage was heading down there. Luckily, I had a press accreditation, so I was able to get past 14th Street, where they were already putting up barriers. And I didn't realise at the time, it's so strange because news travelled so much more slowly. I jumped in a taxi, the taxi driver's radio was broken. While I was in the taxi, the second plane hit the second tower. So I was seeing, as I was getting down there, we passed close to Times Square, people just streaming onto the streets, and they were clutching their faces and sobbing. And I, you know, and it happened more and more the closer I got. And I jumped out of the cab, and I got there probably at about between 9:20 and 9:30, we'll say, and just the chaos at that point. But either way, it was a news story. You could not be there. And then I remember speaking to you later on that day, because I was only down there initially for about an hour and a half. Then I came back. I had to do radio. I was talking to people in RTE, trying to get the information together as we were piecing it. Again, no smartphones, no phone cameras, no nothing back then, even though it was only 20 years ago. And, you know, at that stage, we were hearing all the bridges had been shut into New York, the tunnels were being closed, any planes in the air were going to be shot down. And it was such a fast moving story and such an overwhelming story. And as I say, then after doing some radio, I went back down again. And this time I went to the hospitals, and I remember going to St. Vincent's Hospital, big 800 bed hospital on West 12th. And the doctors and nurses were just standing outside, and there was nobody arriving. One of them told me they'd only seen about 40 people in the previous 3 hours. And another one said, nobody's going to come out of this. Anybody who hasn't been taken out already isn't coming out alive. And at that stage, the towers had collapsed into this awful shape that we all remember, that literally looked like the gates of hell. And then, you know, went back, gathered with my sister, who was over staying with me from Dublin at the time, with friends. We went to the, there were candles being lit and little gatherings all over Manhattan. And we tried to give blood. They wouldn't take blood from me. They told me I looked like I needed blood. There were various things that people were just trying to do. And then I remember really clearly, which was almost like a bookend on such a harrowing day, finally getting to sleep around 2 a.m. and at about 4 a.m., I thought there'd been an earthquake. The whole apartment, I was on the Upper East Side at the time, around 64th Street, was shaking and shuddering, and this deafening noise. And what had happened was fighter planes were shooting down the East Side River, and the noise. And at that point, it was, nobody knew what was going to happen next. Nobody knew what was coming. We knew the Pentagon had been attacked as well. I heard that while I was down at 9/11 on the site. And I was there when the South Tower collapsed. I'd been pushed over to the Brooklyn Bridge, towards the Brooklyn Bridge, before the North Tower went down. But you were hearing snippets of information. The Pentagon had been attacked. There was a lot of, you know, rumours of things that had happened that maybe hadn't happened. Just the fear and the unknown. And as I say, in a news cycle that was very much in real time, where you had CNN and things like that, but nobody really could grapple with what was happening. And again, just as I say, the sense of terror, the sense of, oh my God, what's going to happen next?
Marion, I think we all have the visual memories of what we watched on television, those of us on this side of the Atlantic who weren't there in Manhattan like you were that day. But I think from talking to you before about this, much of what you remember are the sounds of the day. Just tell us why that is.
You know, part of the reason for that, Matt, is in a way because it was such an assault on the senses, the smells, the sights, that I afterwards wondered. I remember seeing things and seeing the things we saw on TV, and I couldn't honestly distinguish afterwards if I had seen certain things firsthand or if I saw them on that endless loop of cable news that went on for months afterwards. But I remember the sounds because I could hear people screaming. I could hear the first responders and the police. They were trying to get people away from the towers, and they were yelling, "Don't look up, don't look up," because people were transfixed. They were staring up at the towers, and we were watching people as they were falling. And I think they thought the only hope they had of getting people to move was to stop looking up. And then I remember the crackle of the radios and things. I could hear them saying, "Send everyone, send everyone." And then the noise when the South Tower went down, and it was almost like everything went quiet for a second. And I remember people beside me yelling and I couldn't hear them. It was like their mouths were just open. And then, as I said, I remember the sobs and the screams and just the exclamations of horror, because people were streaming out of apartment buildings. They were streaming out of high-rise buildings. And the you could just hear this soundtrack, as I said, of sobs and screams and just horror as people were watching people jumping from the Twin Towers. And then the weird thing was people were being pushed. They were being pushed in two different directions. The southern tip of Manhattan becomes very narrow, and the streets, it's not like the grid. The grid kind of ends, which is very easy to navigate, and it becomes all this warren of little streets. And from certain angles, you can't see the Twin Towers at all, or you couldn't when you went down there. And people were being pushed over to the west side to take ferries to get them out, or to the Brooklyn Bridge if they could make it across out on foot. And so when I went towards the Brooklyn Bridge from Fulton Street, and people were just literally like zombies, and some of them had no shoes on, some of them were bleeding, they were covered in this yellow grey dust, and I remember some of them still had their shirts and ties knotted perfectly, but they were covered in white, and there was no sound at all. There was nothing. It was just this silence. There were thousands of people. It was like an exodus over the Brooklyn Bridge, and nobody was talking. And that silence was so chilling to me as well, because again, it was otherworldly. It was something none of us had encountered before on that scale. And as I say, with the uncertainty of, oh my God, what's coming next? What's coming next? And I think that's the real power of terrorism. Yes, it's the shock and the anguish of what's happened and the grief, but it's the anticipation and the dread of what's to come. And that to me was really one of the ways in which this grotesque, atrocious attack succeeded so awfully, in that it really did change how Americans lived their lives, how they viewed things, how people who lived in America lived after that. The damage was so much further than what happened on the day.
Ed Hayes should be with us, a New York attorney who's a regular guest here on the program as well. Ed, thank you for joining us. I think you may be on a train, so the sound quality may not be the best, but what are your memories of that dreadful day 20 years ago?
Well, I represented the families of the police officers that were killed, and I also represented the architect, Daniel Liebskin, who was the architect for the plan for the replacement of the towers. So it was a very significant act in my life after. Now, I was down there, and what I remember are two things in particular. One is the people jumping out of the buildings. All these Irish-looking, red-headed guys running down to the buildings, and it was obvious at that point that nobody was coming out. I mean, the whole buildings were on fire. And I was looking at these guys, like 25-year-old firemen, and they're running down and running into the buildings, and, you know, it's just so obvious that they were going to die. Elements of the fire department. Hello?
Unfortunately, that line is breaking up. I'm not sure we're going to be able to. I think this may be something we may have to come back to with Ed on another occasion, because unfortunately the line is breaking up. I'm finding it hard to hear him, and if I am, I imagine you at home are as well. Chris in Dublin says, I was an hour down the road in New Jersey on a J1 during 9/11. The sense of fear was palpable, as was the subsequent sense of anger and need that Americans felt for revenge. For me, one of the saddest things about 9/11 is that the American response played straight into the hands of what the terrorist wanted. We're going to have another go at talking to Ed Hayes, because Ed, just before the break there, you were telling us about the bravery of the firemen, and I think police officers as well, who all ran into the Twin Towers before they collapsed in the hope of trying to get people out. And unfortunately, many of them perished with these acts of bravery.
One of the smartest things that happened that day was there was an Irish lieutenant, I think, a woman, who had sense enough to blow out the windows of on the ground floor of one of the buildings with her pistol, as a result of which there was a significant opening and a lot of people escaped through it. Actually, if you look at the name of the dead from the first responders, it looked like Hibernian Hall. There was an awful lot of Irish-American names. It was a terrible, terrible day, and we're lost. It's a succession of losses to the terrorists. We lost that day. We lost in Afghanistan. There's been a lot of other successful terrorist attacks. We have to accept that, do something.
Yeah, and you mentioned Daniel Liebeskind, who actually has been a guest on this program previously when he did a building over here in Ireland. And I think he was involved, wasn't he, in the extraordinary memorial, which is now down at the site of the old Twin Towers. It is extraordinary. I was there 3 years ago. I brought my family. My five children weren't even born at the time. The other two were very, very small. But we were all incredibly moved by the way that it has been put together as an extraordinary memorial as to what happened on the day there.
He did a fabulous job with that master plan. He's an absolute genius. It's to the credit of George Pataki, the governor at the time, that he picked him. I can't speak more highly of him. His wife, by the way, Nina, really knows how to manage this process. It was very rough because the guy that was down there, the developer, he's trying to further his economic interests, and Daniel was trying to make the aesthetics as attractive as possible. And by the way, I had a lot of dealings with Giuliani in that circumstance. He behaved completely honorably.
That's what I was just about to ask you about, Ed, because we all think of Giuliani now as this absolute head case hanging around with Donald Trump in the last few years. But he was regarded as a heroic mayor of New York in the aftermath of 9/11.
He did a fabulous job. He did a fabulous job of cutting down a crime in New York. Remember, he's from the same background as uniformly the firemen and the police are from. He's not from a wealthy or even an upper middle class family. He's a neighborhood guy. The people that got killed that day, the first responders, the neighborhood guys. And since I was representing the families of the dead police officers, so I had a lot of dealings with them. He was absolutely honorable and absolutely first-rate in responding to me.
Listener says, I was living in New York during 9/11, had just changed job out of Manhattan to Queens the day before. What upset me so much was the firehouse beside our apartment lost so many men, and the firehouse on the way to work would see and chat to them most days. They were so much a part of the local community. It was also very sad. Ronan Tynan, Irish doctor, famous tenor, you were in Washington on the day, and I suppose, Ronan, what everyone forgets isn't that the Pentagon came under attack that day as well, but everybody focused on what happened in New York.
Yeah, that's right, actually, I'm at. The night before I was singing in Union Station, and there was a lot of political heads there, including the President of the United States and the Prime Minister of England at the time. And the next morning, I was to be in the Pentagon for a meeting about the 50th anniversary of the band for the Air Force and the Navy. And for some unknown reason, Matt, I can't even explain it myself, I slept it out. I got a call and asked me where I was. And it was Bill Fallon's wife, and she was in a north of state. And she said, where are you, Ron? I said, oh, I'm so sorry. I said, I'll be there in 20 minutes. No, she said, stay where you are. She said a plane has just crashed into six rooms close to where Bill was to meet me. And I turned on the TV then, and I couldn't believe it. I thought I was looking at some shocking kind of movie thing, you know, a lethal weapon or something like that. But then after that, it was chaos there. And it was interesting, the last train that left Washington left at 2 o'clock that day of 9/11, and I was on it. And that was the last train that left Washington that day. I got in, and I had a very good association with the NYPD and the FDNY. And the Father's Day fires had happened in August, and I sung at the funerals of those men. And then Kevin Dowdall, who was the captain of one of the firehouses, rang me up and asked me, would I attend some of this? And then 2 days, then I found out that Kevin was killed in 9/11. There was a shocking amount of tragedy associated with it, you know, and as both your previous speakers have said, the unconditional giving of both the fire department, the police department, and they're amazing. I ended up singing at about 63 funerals, which was very tough. And in some cases, when you'd be doing the services, they would have maybe 5 or 6 coffins in the church, maybe 2 people, you know, they found, and then, artifacts of the other 3. And on one occasion, the mass stopped at the offertory because they announced that they found the body of the 2 other men. Matt, it was a tough time.
It was. And go back to you, Marion McKeown, because it did change everything for America, didn't it, from there, that moment onwards?
Oh, it really did. And can I just very quickly, Matt, add on to what Ed and Ronan were just saying? I remember speaking to an Irish woman who was on the 53rd floor of the North Tower when it was struck. Her name was Claire. I can't remember her second name. She worked in finance. And she told me that she had seen the plane coming. She was looking out the window, you know, it was early morning. And she said she was looking at it, but not able to absorb it. And then it hit. And I always remember her describing to me, you know, young Irish woman, she said they were told first to stay put, then they were told to run down, then stay put. And she said they ran towards the stairwells and she saw all these young firemen running up. And she said all she remembered was, as she described to me, she said the big round Irish faces, and they were all red in the face and perspiring. And she said they were joking with them, saying, go on now, go on down, you'll be fine. And she said, like, she remembers seeing the names on their uniforms, and it was Mulrine and Mulroney and all these names. And she said that she only realized that they were never coming back, that as she saw them running up those steps, and they'd already run up with all their equipment, probably 50 steps or more, and they were running to their deaths, basically. And, you know, that was, again, the heroism of the firefighters. And they're such a part of New York. And I think it was, as Ed said earlier, you know, every street corner or whatever, like, you have the firehouse, and they're always joking with the neighbors, and people are getting them coffees and whatever. They're such an integral part of New York's community, and the grief, the outpouring of grief for them afterwards was so palpable. But back to what you asked, it was...
Marion, rather than going to that, I'm actually very taken by something you mentioned about all, and Ed has mentioned, all the Irish Americans, you know, from first generation, second generation, whatever. But I'm really struck by the number of text messages we're getting in from people who were there at the time, Irish people who were living there at the time, people like yourself. And I know in the Tribune at the time, we had Lise Hand also writing from New York at the time, and Dave Hannigan. A listener here, Claire and Bert Hill, saying, Marion is so right. The fear, the silence, and the smell of jet fuel is what I remember of 9/11. I was on my way to the Pentagon in Washington. I stopped to get coffee, and it happened behind me. Fighter jets, Air Force One in the air. I filmed the day's events. Stopped into an Irish bar after hearing about New York. I thought it was a light aircraft until I saw the TV screen. Saw my cousin's building go down. I rang home for 2 minutes before the lines went down. I travelled by train the following day via New York. It took forever, stopping every couple of miles to check the tracks. We were told we were targets from the air. Fear and hardly a word spoken, especially as we came into New York. I couldn't believe what I was seeing and smelling. To this day, I can't watch anything 9/11 related. Thinking about it now, I still get the shivers. And Marion, I think in all the work that you did for weeks afterwards and reporting on it from the Sunday Tribune, you came across so many Irish people who were there who were caught up in it, or who knew people caught up in it.
Right. Yeah. And you know, again, there were there were so many people who, my sister was over on a J1 and you know, she, and we had gone to the Windows on the World the previous Friday. She was planning on going back to Dublin in a week or two. And, you know, I'd been there so many times. I remember going there with Eamon Dunphy, with Alex Meehan, with Carissa Casey, with a whole bunch of journalists. Because when I had visitors over to New York, they'd all go, let's go to the World Trade Center. Let's go to Windows of the World. Now, I'm not great with heights at the best of time. And I still remember that queasy feeling because up on Windows of the World, it was all floor to ceiling glass. So you really got a sense of the spread of New York. And I remember so many friends, Irish people, marveling at that. And but then, like, to get back to, like, speaking to people like Claire, who's, and I called her a couple of weeks later on my mobile to see if she was okay, because I remember thinking, my God, what she went through, seeing the plane, watching it coming, hitting above her head. And then, as I said, her encounter with all those firemen. And she was still very, very traumatized. Now, I lost her number in the interim. My phone was actually stolen, my mobile phone, before we could sync everything on cloud, and her number was in it. And I've wondered since then about her and about several other people that I spoke to, people who were working in the hospitals, who were you know, interns who were Irish, people who were working in the cleanup. And as I said, the fire, the New York Fire and Police, the backbone of them was Irish cops. It was Irish cops, Irish firemen, and then people who were working in finance. I remember John Fitzpatrick from Fitzpatrick's Hotel, and he was, you know, people trying to help, throwing open their doors, saying, like, what can we do? Do people need rooms? Do they need food? And, like, the wonderful thing about New York then was that people couldn't do enough to help. As I say, literally, there were lines around the block outside hospitals, people wanting to give blood, just anything. But the trauma and that was visited on people, and as I said, the fear that was seeded that day, that just grew and grew. It was never extinguished by what America did in response to the 9/11 attacks. I think it just made things in so many ways it's so much worse, because it did. It's like America was almost childlike in its trust, and that trust was just taken away. America had a sense of invincibility. And you have to remember that around 2001, you'd had the Clinton boom, the dot-com boom. America was so rich and fat and happy and complacent. There was almost no unemployment. And they were the undisputed sole military and economic superpower at that stage. And it literally came out of the blue on that morning and changed the world, changed America forever, but also changed the world. And we're still dealing with its legacy today, not just in Afghanistan, but to me, I can draw a direct line between what happened on 9/11 and what happened in America on January the 6th at the insurrection, when the MAGA crowd stormed the Capitol building. America never really recovered.
Marion McCown, thank you. Listen, Ed Hayes, thank you, as our Ronan Tynan, and I'm going to have to leave it, unfortunately. We're out of time and the lines weren't great, but thank you very much. And I will get to some, we've had some extraordinary messages from lots of Irish people who were there on the day. We'll get to some of them all as again.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper.
Weekdays from 4:30. Today.